Hi, I'm Molly Wonsall.
And I'm Geoffrey Wonsall.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we've been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
Which is what prompted us to start this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsall and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wonsall.
Welcome everyone, welcome back. Thank you so much for listening. I hope we don't give you nightmares. As I always say, don't let us give you nightmares.
I think people who like crime don't mind so much.
Oh, that's, I'm not sure that's true. I got one reaction from someone I'd recommended the podcast to. And she said, she wrote me an email saying, I can't take it all, I can't take too much.
Yeah, no, but then she doesn't really like crime.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I find it frightening.
And yeah, yeah, no, but that's not what I'm saying.
No.
I'm saying if you like it, then you'll still listen to it. Of course, there's plenty of people who are like, I can't listen to your podcast because it's too dark.
Yes, and I'm afraid I make no apologies for that. But my other experience...
We didn't commit the crimes.
No, we didn't. But my other experience is that the appetite for true crime now is literally extraordinary.
Yeah, I know.
You know, whether it's dramatised or whether it's true crime documentaries, I mean, the list is extraordinary and growing. You know, it's almost like a torrent. And there's and that reflects the fact that there is an audience out there. And we are very lucky. We get communications from people saying, why don't you do X? And one of our most loyal listeners, Phil, is very good at suggesting topics to us.
Let's take some from Phil's list for next time.
We will. I promise it.
Okay.
Yep. And we've also promised each other that we'd try and do one or two of the great historicals.
Yes, we did. Oh, yeah, we're going to do Jack the Ripper at some point.
At one point, we must do Jack the Ripper. And at one point, we must do the acid bath murderer.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I remember
but,
now.
But today, we're going to do...
We're going to do Robert Black. And we were just discussing, off air, what name we would give him. And I vetoed it because it's unpleasant, because this is going to be a really grim one. So we're just going to call him Robert Black.
Robert Black was called, and I quote, one of the most prolific paedophile murderers ever seen in this country, a man who richly deserved to be called a predatory monster. Black was born on the 21st of April 1947 in Grangemouth, not far from Edinburgh. He was eventually convicted of the murder of four girls, aged between 5 and 11, between 1981 and 1986. In fact, he almost certainly killed at least two more. He was an illegitimate child. His mother gave him up, who's called Jessie Hunter Black. She was 24, unmarried, living on a meagre salary as a factory worker. She gave birth and very quickly passed him off to be fostered. She refused to put her father's name on the birth certificate. And literally, days after giving birth, she gave Robert to Margaret and Jack Tulip, who lived in Kinlochleven, near Glencoe in the West Highlands. Robert lived there for 11 years. 5 years after he arrived, Jack Tulip died when Robert was five. When he was seven, he admitted and remembered went to Highland dancing classes. He remembered being far more interested in lying on the floor and looking up girls' skirts than the dancing. This is the shape of things to come. At the age of eight, while, quotes, looking after a neighbour's baby, he takes the baby's nappy off and starts to examine its orifices. He became fascinated, and I know this is not particularly pleasant, by orifices, all kinds.
That's
Margaret
so
Tulip
grim.
Died when he was 11. And once again, no mother, though a local couple offered to take him in. It was decided he should go to the Reading Children's Home near Falkirk, not very far from where...
That's a good idea. Put him around loads of other children.
Yes, absolutely. He was a chronic bedwetter. He was certainly antisocial. And at the age of 11, he made his first attempt at rape. There was no doubt that he would have been abused in the children's home. It's almost goes without saying. He was later to tell a psychiatrist a horrifying story about when he was 12. He quotes, I quote him, "Me and two other boys went into a field with a girl the same age. We took our knickers off, lifted a skirt, and all tried to put our penises in. Finding that they couldn't, they contented themselves with touching the girl's vagina. When asked if she was consenting to this, Black said, I was forcing her, like, you know. The incident was exposed, and the authorities decided that Black would be better suited to even stricter discipline, and, of course, an all-male environment. But Red House wasn't the right place for Black. One can speculate nowhere would have been the right place for Black. In 1963, when he was 16, he lured a seven-year-old girl from a park to a disused air raid shelter after promising to show her a box of kittens. We've talked about girls being susceptible to dogs.
Using pets as decoys.
Pets, haven't we before?
Yes.
Look at Levi Belfield, yes, and that dog. He choked her until she fell unconscious, and then he molested her and he left her for dead. She was later found wandering on her own in tears and bleeding. Remarkably, and I do use the word advisedly, remarkably, Black was not incarcerated for the crime after being found guilty of lewd and libidinous behaviour.
What? Why the hell not?
It was Scotland. It was 1963. It was a very male environment. I'm not saying it was the right decision. I'm simply saying...
No, you're just telling us what happened.
I'm simply saying,
Jesus,
what happened. This was incidentally... This event took place in my own hometown, Greenock in Scotland.
Oh, yeah.
He went back to Kinlochleven, where he'd been brought up originally by the Tulips. He was called Smelly Bobby Tulip by his fellow pupils at when he was at school, and that's why he changed his name back to his mother's name. He hated the name Tulip.
Mm.
He goes back to where he was raised, again targets a young girl, this time the daughter of a couple he's lodging with. It was a real signature. He's finally convicted of three indecent assaults and sent to Borstal, as there then still was, in Polmont near Falkirk for a year. And that's in 1967. In 1968, after spending a year in Borstal, he moves to London and becomes a lifeguard at the Hornsey Swimming Pool.
Oh, God. They didn't do CRB checks back then or whatever they're called, did they?
No. Where he, again, fondles young girls.
Can't bear it.
He takes photographs of them too. And just to, because it's, you know, begins to store, and this is not long before the internet, he begins to store illegal child pornography. We would now call that the dark web, wouldn't we? But, you know, then it was pictures,
yeah,
passed round. In 1972, he goes to live in a pub in Stamford Hill, North London, with a couple, Eddie and Kathy Rayson. And they always called him a big softie. He was always paid his rent on time. He never caused them any problems. He just used his job at the time at the swimming pool to abuse young girls. But of course, it was a different era. We are talking about the early 70s, where it's the time of the three-day week. It's the time of the lights going out, you know.
What do you mean? What's the three-day week and the lights going out?
Oh, sorry. The early 70s in this country were marked by very severe difficulties with the trades unions. And the then Prime Minister, Edward Heath, declared at one point in late 1973 that Britain could only work 3 days of the week. There had been enormous power cuts as well. Parts of London were blackout.
When they had the winter of discontent and no one picked up the rubbish?
No, that was the winter of 78 into 79.
Okay.
Yeah, it's slightly different. There was, before that, there had been postal strikes. I was a young reporter on the Times and I was always reporting on something not working. You know, it was something had gone wrong. Anyway, Black doesn't stay at the Hornsey swimming pool for very long. In fact, he gets a job working for a firm called Poster Dispatch and Storage as a driver. And he drives around the country, particularly the London to Edinburgh run, delivering posters that, you know, these days you'd see in bus sides, you know, if for the latest pop concert or the latest show or the latest book or whatever. And he stays with them for the next 10 years. He also took to, how can I put it politely, changing his appearance. At one point he would have a beard, another point he would shave it off. He would have long hair, then he would change it. He put on glasses, false glasses. Take him up again. He was, if you like, perfecting the skill that he was to use to kill. In 1978, a 13-year-old girl called Jeanette Tate vanished while she was delivering newspapers in Aylesbury in Devon. Her body was never found. Black was a suspect after his final arrest, but he was never convicted of this murder. Questioned about it, certainly, but there was not enough evidence to bring against him. Ironically, he would never be convicted of Jeanette Tate. But on the 12th of August, 1981, a 9-year-old girl called Jennifer Cardy was about to set off from home on her new red bicycle. She lives in Northern Ireland, in County Antrim. When she didn't return, her mother began to worry. And as it turned out, Jennifer had never reached her friend's house. Her father called the police at around 9 o'clock that evening and the operation escalated. Just before midnight, two local men spotted Jennifer's new red bicycle, in a field. It had been thrown over the wall. Poignantly, the stand was down, as though she'd got off a bicycle to speak to her abductor. It was one of Northern Ireland's biggest ever searches at that point, and in fact, it was to be 6 days before her body was found by two duck hunters floating in a dam behind a lay-by on the road. 6 days, 10 miles from where she'd been cycling. No one was ever found at the time. A year passes. It's now the 30th of July, 1982, and an 11-year-old girl called Susan Maxwell was abducted. She was living in the borders between Scotland and England, and she'd been playing tennis with a friend on the other side of the Tweed, and she was walking back across, it was quite a wide river at that point because it's really quite near the sea, from Coldstream to Berwick. It had been the first time she'd been allowed by her parents to go out unaccompanied. You can imagine how she must have felt.
Oh no, that's the worst.
Yeah, you can imagine how much she must have been looking forward to it and, you know, enjoying her freedom. I'm absolutely certain in my own mind that Susan Maxwell spent at least 24 hours in Robert Black's van. 2 weeks later, a body was found in a ditch next to a lay-by outside Uttoxeter in the Midlands, 250 miles from where Susan had been abducted. The body had been decomposed. 2 weeks in the hot sun, she could only be identified by her dental records. The only clue, in fact, the pathologist could never determine exactly how she did die. The only clue was that her pants had been folded and put under her head.
Well, he'd put it in the lay-by, but done that, put the folded pants under the head.
Yes, in a ditch.
That's so deliberate.
Yep. Friday, July 1983 at the seaside resort of Portobello, just outside Edinburgh, a five-year-old girl called Caroline Hogg was abducted. She asked her mother if she could go down the road to the playground. Her mother, Annette, let us go for 5 minutes with the stern warning she wouldn't go any further. When 15 minutes had passed, she sent her son, Stuart, to look for Caroline. They couldn't find her. They called the police at about 8. There are reports that a scruffy man was seen holding hands with Caroline at Fun City, a fairground forbidden to her. They assembled a search party of 600. Nothing was found. Until on the 18th of July, 10 days later, her body was found in a lay-by at Twycross in Leicestershire, not far from the A444, 300 miles away. She was completely naked. And she'd been kept captive, I'm sure in my own mind, for at least 24 hours by Maxwell. It is a terrifying litany. We now spin forward. A task force is created, to be fair to the police. They begin to join the dots. You know, it's the early 80s. That, you know, they realise now that you can have the Yorkshire Ripper, and you know, got
especially because the bodies are like being in lay-bys and miles away from where they're. So well, you know that the person's got a van and is travelling all exactly. over the place. So that you know.
Yes, that bit is clear, isn't
you
it?
You know the MO.
Yeah. Anyway, Black is obviously aware that you know eyes are out, and so he goes quiet until March 1986. When a 10-year-old called Sarah Harper, her mother asks her to go to the corner shop about 100 yards and buy a loaf of bread. It's about 8 o'clock in the evening. At 8:15, her mother starts to worry, and at 9 o'clock the police are called. Almost 3 weeks later, a man walking his dog by the River Trent sees something floating in the water. It's a body. It's in fact Sarah Harper. It was later to be established that Sarah's body was put into the river at junction 24 of the M1 while she was still alive. This is almost too much for me. It is established, the post-mortem, that the injuries were utterly terrible. She had been violently attacked. Violently sexually attacked. Again, briefly, Black goes quiet until in April 1988, a man approaches a 15-year-old called Teresa Thornhill and asks her if she could fix his engine. She replied she couldn't, walked away. He grabbed her and carried her to his van, but she was able to break free, grabbed him between the legs, screamed, and her friend Andrew ran over, which made the man drop her and run. No proper description, but it was obviously Black. She described him as between 40 and 50, overweight, balding, heavily built, and about 5'7".
Well, that's useful.
Yeah, it was. 2 years pass. 2 more years. We're now in 1990. It's July. It's again the summer. 14th of July. And in Stowe in Scotland, not Stowe in the Wold in Gloucestershire, a 6-year-old called Mandy Wilson is walking to a friend's house to play. One of her neighbours, and I think this is, it's horrifying, but it's an absolutely wonderful story. One of her neighbours, a retired postmaster, is mowing the lawn. And he sees a van, blue van, pull up, and he sees a man snatch this 6-year-old off the pavement, shove her in the back of the van and drive off. But he had the presence of mind to write down the registration number of the van.
Yes, I love this man.
Write down the registration number of the van and phone the police. By an astonishing twist, the van had been going up past his house a number of minutes, 10. He sees the van coming back, down the road, and shouts out to the police who come to interview him, "That's the man, that's him." They handcuffed the man, and he identified himself as Robert Black.
Is she in the back of the van?
Mandy was indeed in the back of the van, her hands tied behind her back, elastoplast across her mouth, and stuffed into a sleeping bag. He had already assaulted her. One of the great ironies of this case is the man who opened the back of the van to discover Mandy was her father, a policeman.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's so sad.
Yeah. The evidence against Black for this abduction is utterly overwhelming. I mean, I think the judge called it when he finally went to trial in August 1990, chillingly cold calculation. Not a rush of blood, absolutely premeditated. But that is the only crime at that point that Black is convicted of. It's simply abduction. It takes a very long time for the police to finally establish that Black is a serial killer as well as an abductor of children. In fact, it's not until 1994.
He's still in prison though, right?
Oh, yes.
He was given
life in trial.
Okay.
Life in prison for the abduction. It isn't until the second trial in Newcastle in April 1994 when Black pleads not guilty to 10 charges of kidnap, murder and attempted kidnap. Susan Maxwell, 11, from Cornhill, mm-hmm. on the Tweed. Caroline Hogg, 5, from the Portobello. And Sarah Harper of Morley, not far from Leeds. He pleads not guilty, but the judge is not buying it. Neither are the jury. But there is no... very, very few. It's what's called similar fact evidence. It's the weight of similarity. Mm. They don't have CCTV. They don't have brilliant forensics. And as the prosecutor said, Black is every parent's worst nightmare. On the 19th of May, 1994, he's convicted of the 3 murders. The father of one of the victims called him a man of the most evil kind, and I absolutely agree with him. Black is absolutely horrifying, a depraved monster. Finally, the girl in Armagh, Jennifer Cardy, Black is brought to trial in September 2011. Again, he pleads not guilty, but on the 27th of October 2011, he's found guilty. The defence barrister, when asked by the judge if there's any mitigation, stood up and said, "There is no mitigation." It was about power, as it always is. It was about paedophilia, as it truly is. The police were about to bring a case against him for the disappearance in Devon, but Black died. They were about to bring him to trial for Jeanette Tate, the 13-year-old from Devon. Black died of a heart attack at the age of 68 in jail. It was premeditated, predatory paedophilia of the worst possible kind. And Black got away with it
for a long time.
For a very long period of time. Because, as we've seen in other cases, but it's also true, even more so in the United States, if you travel long distances, it's very difficult to... It's not a local killing. This is the worst kind, really. It's a random...
The opportunist.
A random predator.
Mm.
They are rare, and Black was rare, but he was of the most monstrous kind. The only thing I can say now by way of conclusion is that I've talked about Black's case on a number of occasions in the past, and each time it makes my skin creep. He is just unimaginably evil man. And I'm sorry it's such a horrid case, but he really is one of the most evil monsters, and probably one of the lesser known.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, who, if you stop someone in the street, unless they're a real true crime bruff, who's Robert Black, they'll say, well, who's he?
Yeah.
And yet if you do the case, if you examine the case, he's absolutely relentless.
Evil.
And it could well be that there have been other crimes which have simply never landed to his door.
Yeah.
We don't know. So I don't, sorry, it's not a particularly...
Miserable.
It is, yes.
And that was...
And also that preoccupation with orifices, it's always made me cringe. It's just awful. This is an awful, awful man. The only good part of this otherwise terrible story is the quick-wittedness of the man mowing his lawn.
Thank God for the man mowing his lawn in Stowe.
Yes.
Hats off to you, sir.
Yes.
Salute you.
Absolutely. And yet, even then, in the midst of catching him, the person who opens the door...
No, that's too much. That nearly made me cry. I can't deal with that at all. Well, thank you, Robert Black.
I don't think you want to thank me for Robert
I
Black.
Want to thank you, but I mean, I thank you for telling us the story. It's important for us to know these things too.
He is a very interesting case.
You can't like true crime and then get to pick and choose, you know.
No, no.
If people are depraved and evil, and we have to examine each one.
Yes, and we've got to be very careful not to overuse the word monster, but I do think Black deserves it.
I don't think you do. I don't think you do at all. I think you're very sensible about, you know, when people have had a hard time and, you know, go wrong, or when people are truly evil.
I think it's little doubt that Black was bad from the beginning.
Yeah, born bad, 100%. Yeah. I totally agree with you.
I don't think
you have to be to do that. You have to be.
You think?
Born bad.
You don't think it was the fact that he was fostered out and didn't like being smelly Bobby Tulip and...
No.
It wasn't the fact that he was going to take his revenge on girls. I think that...
No.
That line about Highland dancing, I like lying on the floor, is a very telling one.
No, I don't think if you get sexual satisfaction from doing that to children, then you're bad. You're bad through and through.
Yeah, and they were all children.
On that note, let's step away from this because it's making me feel very unhappy.
Yeah, let's step away from it, Mo. I couldn't agree more. What's good this week? I'm back on. I'm back in.
You're back doing more filming. All you do is filming.
Yeah, back doing.
You're the someone, talking head.
Back doing someone we've done.
Oh, doing
Dale
someone,
Cregan.
Oh yeah, Dale Cregan. God, you remember we were like Cregan the whole way through.
Yeah.
Should have googled
it. The one-eyed gangster.
Yeah, I remember him well.
Yeah, so do I.
It's quite a fantastic, like the gangsters.
It's a fascinating case.
That's good. You've done him before.
Yeah.
Jeffrey was saying earlier that he had been able to listen back to one of our podcasts as a refresher on someone else he had to do a talk about. So it's not all wasted work, Dad.
No. On the contrary, I don't see any of it as wasted. On the contrary, I'm my database grows by the day.
No.
My filing grows by the day. I think it's fascinating, genuinely, and I like to be able to put it in as carefully as possible. You know, you want to try and bring these cases.
You do construct it carefully. I was thinking then as well, you very sensibly, you hint at detail, but you don't go into detail.
No, I think some of it's just so unpleasant. You simply wouldn't want to. I do feel that very strongly that some things are best left unsaid.
It's not respectful either.
No.
It's not respectful to the people who lost children. And
no, not respectful of the victims or their families.
Yeah.
And I'm very conscious. And in fact, that's a very interesting point. I'm very conscious of, you know, how can you take pleasure in the terrible things that people do? I try to do it in the most careful way I possibly can.
I don't think we're taking pleasure in it. You know a lot about crime, and we're harnessing your knowledge and sharing it with other people in hopefully a respectful way.
I hope so. I very much do. So this week I've got some new books to review. Interesting ones. I'm reviewing a very interesting French crime thriller.
Oh, I'm really into French crime.
Called The Reunion.
There's some good French crime on Netflix if anyone's looking for a new series.
Yes, very good. It's called The Reunion. It's a massive seller in France. Sold 500,000 copies. Translated into gazillions of languages. And it's very, very clever.
Has it been optioned? I imagine so.
Oh, yes. But it's fascinating, actually. It's 25 years later. And a boy who's fallen hopelessly in love with a fellow student, a 19-year-old girl called Vinca. And Vinca has fallen in love with the philosophy teacher.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, okay. And the unrequited love, this boy, they go to a school reunion 25 years later. And they're about to discover the body because the boy and his friend...
Killed the teacher.
But then Vinca disappeared and never to be seen again.
But they didn't kill Vinca.
No. It's beautifully
good
done.
Good setup.
It's very, very beautifully done. And it all brought to a head because I won't spoil the story, but it's beautifully, beautifully done.
Nice.
So I heartily recommend it.
Cool. Thank you very much. Well, just as usual, thank you to Jeffrey. Thank you to our producer, Poppy Damon. Thank you to my brother for doing the music, my friend George for drawing our picture, my friend and colleague Hannah for giving us
so much
advice
help.
And help, and thank you to Audio Boom for looking after us.
Thank you all. Believe me, it's most heartfelt. And as I always say, please don't let it give you nightmares, and do be careful out there.